first time ever, the Aldi Literary Lunch went to Northern Ireland, to Clandeboy, a spectacular house and estate just outside Belfast. It was also to celebrate the 200th anniversary of the greatest diplomat of the Victorian age, the first Marquess of Dufferin and Arva, who lived at and remodeled the house and estate at Clandeboy. His biographer, Andrew Gailey, was among the speakers. Other speakers were Robert Hardman on Elizabeth II, Ian Wilson on the Great Exhibition, and Prue Leith on Being Old and Learning to Love It.
Our next speaker is one of our greatest writers and journalists. He's a terrific reporter. If you look at the footage of that sad moment when Notre Dame burned down a few years ago, the first people into the burning cathedral was the diminutive figure of President Macron, then the slightly bigger French fireman, and then the towering figure of Robert Hardman walking in behind them. He's a terrific journalist, originally for The Telegraph, now for The Daily Mail. And he is now one of our leading royal biographers. He's written a biography of the King and four biographies of the late Queen. And the latest one for her centenary in April is Elizabeth II in Private, in Public, The Inside Story. Ladies and gentlemen, Robert Hardman.
Clandeboy, I've never been here before. I can see why the King, who has been here, thinks so highly of it. I get slightly Dumfries House vibes. I don't know if any of you have been to Dumfries House, which is that wonderful house in Ayrshire, which the King has rescued and given a new lease of life. And I do sense a similar new purpose going on here under Ian and Harry and others. So thank you for inviting me. It was actually, I discovered it was had its first royal visit in 1924, when the then Duke and Duchess of York, future George VI and Queen Elizabeth, came here to stay for the weekend. Not long after that, just 2 years later, along came the subject of my book, Elizabeth II. And as Harry said, I have written one or two books about it before. My children said when I announced I was doing another book, "Oh, Dad, I mean, honestly, can't we leave that poor woman alone?" But I wanted to do something for her centenary. This is her centenary year. And this is the first book I have written in the past tense. It was quite sad at times, writing was instead of is. But there was, and another thing we said was, well, there can't be anything new to say about Elizabeth. So surely it's all been said. All I can say is there was a very great deal to say. New perspectives, new documents, new people to interview. I'll come on to my slightly bizarre weekend with her last state visitor at Mar-a-Lago in a minute. But really what comes through, I hope, in the book, and I certainly found this when I was writing, again and again, is her deployment of royal soft power. We hear a lot about soft power these days. We saw it exemplified just the other day in Washington, the King's visit, the state visit. And that was really the story of her life. I mean, right from an early age, at the height of the Blitz, 1940, there she is broadcasting from Windsor Castle to the children, all the evacuees around Britain and indeed the Empire. That wonderful speech which finishes where she essentially just saying, it's going to be okay, all will be well. The end, she goes, come on, Margaret, let's all say goodnight. And it's such a sort of sweet broadcast. Arguably the darkest moment of Britain could possibly imagine, possibly on the eve of an invasion. It just captures perfectly the mood. And it was actually shortly afterwards turned to a record in the United States. The US at this point is still neutral in the war, and yet it's broadcast by this 14-year-old princess. Is turned into a record. She has her first hit across the pond at the age of 14. And that's the way it's going to be. And she adores her father. She wants to reign in the image of her father. I mean, we look through history, it's littered with monarchs falling out with their heirs and successors, but not this time. She adored him, he adored her. And then, of course, her world turned upside down in February 1953. 1972, she was in the branches of a giant fig tree in the Aberdare National Park in Kenya. The king has died. She's one of the last people to know, but suddenly she's a 25-year-old mother of two, and she's the head of state of a large part of the Earth's surface. And it's a huge shock. But it gets off to a great start. I divide her reign really into sort of three what I call golden eras. There's a lot of bumpy bits in between. But that first golden era really is sort of a forward year and after the coronation of 53, when she is seen as this fabulously glamorous new monarch. Through this, Britain is going to be rejuvenated. You know, we're going to be great once again, even though, of course, the empire by now is already over and Britain is nearly bankrupt. But it's a pretty good start, but it doesn't last for very long. By 1956, the honeymoon period is over. And Britain and Washington are at loggerheads over a strip of water in the Middle East. Sounds vaguely familiar, doesn't it? And the Suez Crisis is a complete disaster. And as I said, Washington and Downing Street are on non-speaks. What do we do to patch up the pretty battered special relationship at this point? Well, we send the monarch on a state visit to the USA, and guess what? It's a great success. Again, sounds familiar. And the 60s come on. The 60s are not a great period for the monarchy. They're seen as a bit behind the curve. It's not. It's fine. They just seem a bit sort of dollary and dusty. And then everything changes at the end of the 60s with the first ever royal documentary. And that changes perceptions. And in the 70s, actually, the Queen comes into her own. Britain is progressively becoming more and more of a basket case, culminating, of course, in 1976 with the loan from the IMF. We really are a joke. No one really wants to have very much to do with Britain per se, certainly not the government or strikes. And, you know, I remember doing lights going out or being homework, all that stuff. It's totally different when it comes to the monarch. The Queen is the star of the show. Exactly 50 years ago, she set sail to America in 1976 for the bicentenary. And it's a complete triumph. They absolutely love it. She arrives in Philadelphia in her yacht, and she sails up and down the eastern seaboard, and she's absolutely the star of the show. There's one glitch on the White House lawn when President Ford invites her up for the first dance at the big ball to celebrate 200 years of independence. And at that very moment, the band decides to strike up. That's why the lady is a tramp. Ford is appalled. She thinks it's the funniest thing that's happened all year and died out of it forever after. But then we're into what I would call her second golden era. That starts 50 years ago next year, that Silver Jubilee. The Silver Jubilee, and at the time, 25 years on the throne, seemed a big deal. Of course, it was going to go on to be 70. And a very key part of that happened here in Northern Ireland, because she was determined to visit all parts of her kingdom. And the government of the day, Jim Callaghan's government, said, "Where are you going? In Northern Ireland, it's too dangerous." She said, "Well, I'm going." But they wouldn't let her go in a car. And this caused a problem, because the one thing she hated, the only thing she was terrified of in her whole life, were helicopters. She'd do anything else. Didn't mind, you know, terrorist shootings, maimings, whatever. She hated helicopters. And they said, "Well, the only way you can go around Northern Ireland is in a helicopter." So she went, "All right." So she transferred from the Royal Yacht to a frigate, got in a helicopter, and that's how she got around Northern Ireland. At the end, there's a culmination of that Silver Jubilee tour. And it was a rough ride. I mean, it was actually a bomb went off at the University of Coleraine on the morning she was meant to be there. Merlin Rees, the Home Secretary, was trying to stop it, saying, "I don't think you should go." And she said, "No, no, no, well, the bomb's already gone off, I'm going." And that was a key moment. But that mark, as I said, was that sort of second golden era, right way through the 80s, grandchildren coming on, everything's looking great. But that's not how the path of royal fortune always goes. And suddenly, of course, the 90s are a disastrous time for the monarchy. I remember I was in the room with her in the Guildhall when she delivered that famous speech about Anna Cyrilla. It's the voice. She already had a cold, very sort of reedy voice. And it was all the worse because she was actually suffering from smoke inhalation. Windsor Castle had just burned down. She'd been inside the castle when it was on fire, retrieving family documents. So she had this very weak voice, but it was a very powerful speech. And the 90s, as we know, terrible time for monarchy, went all the way through to the new millennium. It was a time of serious rebooting, reform, a time when a lot of people thought she might just chuck it in, but she was never going to do that. She stuck at it. And then we get to on through the noughties, and things pick up. And really, you get to that third golden era, the final golden era, and it starts really at the tail end of 2010 with the engagement of William and Catherine. And really comes alive in the spring of 2011 with that magnificent state visit to Ireland. I'm sure a lot of you in this room remember it. I was covering it at the time. And in the space of 4 days, I think she completely reset the dial on bilateral relations across the Irish Sea. It was a staggering piece of statecraft. It was just very deftly done. Both the Foreign Office and the Irish government only thought she was going to be there for a couple of days. For the first time ever, they got a call from the palace saying actually the Queen would like to double the length of the state visit, but she wants to go for 4 days. And it was great. And of course, the following year, we had the Diamond Jubilee, the Olympics, that glorious sight of her jumping out of a helicopter with James Bond. She's at the height of her powers, and that goes right the way on to 2018, another royal wedding, which, well, we won't talk about that too much, but well, the two actually, Harry and Meghan and Eugenie got married that year. And then 2019, again, the Wheel of Fortune turns. It's an appalling year for the monarchy. There's Prince Andrew's Newsmate interview, there's the whole row about prorogation, Prince Philip has a terrible car crash, things are going in the wrong direction, culminates in what we call Megxit and the departure of the Sussexes early in the new year. But again, the Queen does not give up, she does not wind down. Her authority is undiminished. On she goes. COVID happens very soon afterwards. We see her at the height of her powers, and the COVID pandemic, I think, actually showed it was 80 years almost to the month of her first broadcast and as a princess at the height of the Blitz. There she is again at Windsor, broadcasting to the nation, it's going to be okay, folks. We're going to get through this. Incredibly powerful delivery. And very soon, I'm going to give it a 1 minute warning, so I'll speed up. Of course, 2 years later, she has left us. She's died, but that soft power continues. And that soft power is why, just 6 months ago, I found myself at Mar-a-Lago. I wanted to talk to the last state visitor of her reign. She welcomed more state visitors than anybody ever. And Donald Trump being the very last one. And slightly bumpy start when I arrived. So I'll be at the golf club at 9 a.m. on a Saturday. Jumped on a plane to Miami. I was there. He began by going, "Why? I don't know anything about an interview." And I said, "Well, I want to sit writing a biography about the Queen, Mr. President, and you see if you get on with her." And he went, "Okay, do you want something to eat?" So we had breakfast and we chatted and ended up having several conversations. And at the end of it, at the end of a very surreal weekend, he said, I've got something to ask you. I've got this picture of the Queen." And he bought a copy of the last portrait that I've ever done by a brilliant British Polish artist called Basia Hamilton. And she painted Trump as well, so I found out about it. And he got this picture of her, and he didn't know what to do with it. He didn't know where to put it in Mar-a-Lago. He decided she has to have a room of her own. She can't get alongside any other portraits. And the house, by the way, has quite a lot of portraits of him in it. And he said, no, she's got to have a space of her own. And I was directed to the room, and I went in there. And to this day, if you go into Mar-a-Lago, there in the dining room is this great Venetian fresco. Nothing, wonderful maritime scene. And he's whacked a nail in the wall. And there, in pride of place, on her own, here, the great Mark Quincy sharing the wall space with lots of other people. Not at Mar-a-Lago. There is only one portrait hanging in the dining room there. That is Elizabeth II. Ladies and gentlemen, that is soft power. That is why I think we can all agree we were privileged to have lived during the reign of one of the greats. Thank you very much.
This week's podcast was kindly sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors, who take a long-term approach to investing in exceptional companies.